Good morning. So this morning I'm going to talk, this is my eighth talk on the Genjo Koan by Dogen, written in 1232, I'm not sure, around then. And I'm not going to finish today, I'm going to give one more after this. Just to review a little bit. So, Genjo Koan. So, Genjo means to actualize, to bring alive. And Koan means reality. To bring reality alive in our lives. Usually we're trying to stuff reality. We're trying to alter reality. We're trying to wish reality away. We're trying to, through our muscular, mental, and physical effort, change reality. Well, all that stuff is fine, but first we have to actualize reality. First we have to become active in this reality that we're in. And each of us is in a different one. Now, each of us really is in the same one, but we're in it. Our predicaments are different. Our contradictions are different. Our hopes and fears are different. Base level, they're not. So that's koan. So we're actualizing reality, and reality means, a koan means, sameness is ko on difference. So we're actualizing, we're bringing alive that sameness within difference, difference within sameness. On the one hand, we want to kind of go along with everybody else to fit in. We feel that we're same, that we're one people. But then we deny our own individual vitality, our own personal authenticity. So we have to pay attention to that too. Then we get attached to our own personal authenticity and we forget that that authenticity is the authenticity of all of life working through us. So Genjo Koan. And taking off where I left off last time, from the text, therefore, if there are fish who want to swim, or birds who want to fly, only after, is this working? Can you guys hear me? Good. Only after they investigate the entire sky, or all the water, welcome. Only after they investigate the entire sky, or all the water, they will neither find place, nor path, nor place. When we make this very place our own, our practice becomes a manifestation of reality. When we make this path our own, our activity naturally becomes actualized reality. So Dogen is one of the things he's saying here, when we haven't made this place our own, we want to investigate everything so we can find our place. And we're hungry ghostish about this. This isn't the right place. This place will be a little better. This way of doing zazen, this way. That investigation goes on forever. And then we're not ever here. We're not ever here. So, in my life, I've worked, a lot and had personal experience a lot because of my own family connections with immigrants, with first generation immigrants, second generation immigrants, even third generation, but mostly first and second. And a lot of those people are really struggling to find their place. I mean, what you would expect it, wouldn't you? Because they've left behind the home of their childhood, or their parents left behind that home. And they don't feel like they have a place here. It's much harder for them. Here meaning wherever they are, because they have left behind that home, and they don't know if they'll ever see it again. Only they go back to it, but it's not the same. But from the Buddhist point of view, we're all immigrants, because we're all in migration. The first law of Buddhism is everything's changing. I go back to my home, and it's not there anymore. My friends aren't there, my dad's dead, the house has been bulldozed. We're all immigrants. We're all in migration. We're all leaving something and going towards something else. And it's not that pleasant. It creates a koan for us. It creates a tension for us. A tension between sameness and difference, between before and now and after, that is part of Zen practice. So Katagiri Roshi, who was the head teacher here and whom many of you knew, he was an immigrant. He was an immigrant. And he was already a Dharma heir when he came to this country, meaning he was an independent teacher, but he was an immigrant. And I've talked before about being with him at a rock and roll concert in San Francisco with the Grateful Dead and Big Brother and the Holding Company and Janis Joplin. For those of you who are really old, who are into that stuff, maybe, actually, I noticed that a lot of people who aren't very old are into that stuff. So, but, and so we had one of these, we had a few of these. They had them all the time. I only went to a few. And so, Katagiri Roshi was there, and he looked like he was not in his place. He looked like he was not in his place. He thought he was going to London, and he ended up in the Haight-Ashbury. I mean, they had an image of America which is more like London, and they ended up in the Haight-Ashbury. Do you know what I'm talking about? It was hard for them, really hard. And he was not in his place. He was not in his place. Then, 28 years later, I visited him in the hospital after he had been really practicing wholeheartedly for 28 more years. He was a young man at the Fillmore Auditorium in 19, whatever it was. 28 years later, I visited him in the hospital and he was dying of cancer. And I visited him with my friend Paul, and he was obviously in a lot of pain, but he had a certain composure and a certain just openness that felt good. We felt good being there. Right in the middle of the pain, we felt, oh, comforted by him. He was the one in pain. But we felt comforted, Paulina, because he had found his place, his very own place. We just discover this little by little in our Zen practice, little by little. And that's what Zen practice is about, to discover this place that's really our very own and not feel pulled in so many directions anymore by past, present, and future. By what has been, will be, should have been, might be, might have been. So, somebody said once that a real Zen master doesn't have to have much in the way of ability, doesn't have to be very smart, or very good at ritual, how about that one? Or have a great posture, how about that one? Only that person has to know how to die. How to die. How to die. It's not something I can tell you about. I can't tell you about it. So when my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, gave Dharma transmission, that means authorization to teach to his his chief disciple, Zentatsu Baker Roshi, who had some flaws but was great in a way, was really great. He said to him, this is what I'm paraphrasing this, but this is what I read. You were determined to try to fly, even though you didn't know if you would soar over the ocean or plunge into it. And he was like that. All of the Zen in California came out of what Zen Tatsu did. Tassajara, Green Gulch, if those of you guys have been to California and seen the Zen. Because he was not afraid. We all thought, what? Are you crazy? We said to him, are you crazy? And Suzuki Roshi said, no, he's not crazy. He's not crazy. It can be done. So last time I talked about Dogen going to China. Dogen, when he was in his mid-20s, went to China with his teacher, Myo Zen. He was already Myo Zen's Dharma heir in his 20s. They got enlightened young in those days. Or something. I don't know. And Dogen and Myo Zen really wanted to go to China. And to go to China was a big deal. It took a month on a boat. The boats from Japan came every 5 years. Often they leaked and people died. Everybody died. But they really wanted to go to China. Because Dogen was still, even though he was Dharma heir, he still didn't feel like this place was his very own. And his teacher knew he didn't feel that way because his teacher wasn't too dumb. And anyway, Dogen told him, you know. But Dogen had all these other wonderful qualities. Dogen was a scholar. Dogen was elegant in the way he did a ritual. And Dogen was passionate about the Dharma. He was passionate about it. But he still had this question, which if you study Dogen, you know what it is. It's, if we all have Buddha nature, if I have the Buddha nature, then why does the sitting not really show it? I mean, poor guy's been sitting for 10 years, right? Sound familiar, anybody? I don't want to discourage anyone. And you wanted to go to China to the source, right? Go to the source. Wherever that may be, whatever that is. And Myo Zen, his teacher, wanted to support him and go with him. Because Myo Zen saw that he was a good teacher himself in some ways, but he couldn't help Dogen with this. There's only so much we can do to help other people with resolve their issues. There's only so much we can help people do to let go of their feeling that they're always immigrants or emigrants and that they're never really here. There's only so much. But Myo Zen could help him go. He could help him go. So I'll help you go. And so Myo Zen's teacher was very old, and Myo Zen's teacher, you know, in China there were many generations, and of course, well, I won't get into that whole thing. But anyway, his teacher didn't want him to go, Myo Zen's teacher, Dogen's grandfather, right, grandfather teacher. Because Myo Zen's teacher was dying, and he wanted his chief heir to stay and do the funeral and say goodbye. But Myo Zen said, I have to go. I have to go. This is what I really want to do. This is my inmost desire to support him. Sometimes our inmost desire is a little selfish, but our life is short. So maybe you shouldn't evaluate it too much. If it really comes out of a deep place, you really should honor it because your life is going. The birds are flying. Migration is going pretty, it's going faster and faster all the time. At least for an old person, it's going faster and faster all the time. Maybe not for you young people. But wait. So, Myo Zen went with him, and Myo Zen said, even if I die on the trip, this is what I want to do, even if I die in China. And what happened? Myo Zen died in China. He died in China. And Dogen brought his remains back to Japan. And they were a month on the boat, and everybody was seasick the whole time, and the boat almost capsized, and But Dogen and Myozen were so intent on what they were doing that they were able to just do fine and help people. Dogen talks about this with their nausea. He doesn't go into the details. He just says that.
He was the guy in the Hawaiian shirt.
He was the guy in the Hawaiian shirt. That's right. That's another talk. So, Dogen says a little later in Genjo Kōen, if you penetrate one thing, you penetrate all things. If you penetrate one thing, you penetrate all things. In a way, Dogen and Myozen, with their one-pointedness, and then Dogen later in China, I mean, because Myozen went with Dogen to China, Dogen never could have gone by himself. We have Soto Zen. Because Myozen was selfish in a way, but he had this deep desire. We have the sin here, because I won't get into that story today. That's five more talks, right? But Myozen died, and Dogen brought his remains back a few years later, just his ashes. So they really were. Both of them were doing what they loved. And to find something you really love and do it, not just that you think would be nice, but something you really love deeply, and do it, it's you can be a bodhisattva. You don't have to be some other kind of bodhisattva than that way, really. But lots of times we don't find anything we deeply love. Or we do, and then it's hard. Well, sure, it's hard. It was hard for Dogen. It's hard for Dogen because he was already a teacher, and here he had to humble himself by being sick for a month on the boat and going to see a Chinese guy who didn't even speak his language to really, really do what he loved, which was immerse himself and teach the Dharma. He could have been a Dharma teacher at 25, but he knew that there was something lacking. He knew that he was still in migration. Of course, we're all in migration anyway, so don't get stuck on the idea that once you get some enlightenment, you won't be in migration. It's just that then you'll just be able to fly, as you do whenever you're authentically in your place, in this place, right? So, in my last few lectures, I've been talking about Reverend Ozawa. Reverend Ozawa in Japan, who lost his legs in World War II. And all he wanted to do was sit like Dogen says in Fukanza Zengi. Dogen tells us exactly how to sit. You know, full lotus is preferred. Half lotus is okay. You know, spine is straight, etc., etc. Well, Ozawa had no legs, right? So he could not do what he loved. He really wanted to do it, but he couldn't do it. And he couldn't get into a heiji, because if you know anything about Japanese form, they never would let him into a heiji. He couldn't get into Sojiji. Even in the urban temple, they wouldn't let him in. But he wanted to manifest the Dharma. He wanted to penetrate it and manifest it. He really believed that if you penetrate one thing, you manifest all things. He really believed that. So he couldn't do what he loved, so he had to settle for what? Loving what he could do. Loving what he could do. He had to settle for that. And because he settled for that, he became a great Zen teacher. Even though he never got to go to a Heiji or Sojiji, I've talked about what he did. He repeated to himself, as his focus of his zazen, which he could not do cross-legged. I don't know how he did it, actually. Born now, born now, born now. And when the terror would come in from the past, he just kept with it. He didn't love what he was doing at first, but he did it, he did it, he did it. And after a while, there was no gap between that, and sitting. No gap. No gap. So penetrate one thing, and we can penetrate all things. And it's not even very mystical. Not even very mystical. And of course, if we think we have to investigate the entire sky first, oh, we just exhaust ourselves. We exhaust ourselves. So Dogen, now I'm toward the end of Genjo Koan, and Dogen ends Genjo Koan by telling a story about a Zen master named Magu. Magu. And I'm not going to tell that story today because I'm going to spend the whole time on it next time. But I'm going to talk a little bit about Magu and why Dogen was fond of Magu. Not that he knew Magu. Fond of him in the sense that the Japanese in the 13th century were reading the Chinese teachers from the 8th, 9th century and learning about their Zen. And that's why he wanted to go to China to meet one that was still alive. He said, enough of this reading. I want to meet one. So, Magu. I'm going to tell a background story about Magu, which relates to very much this quest. So Magu, I can say, was a Zen teacher who knew how to make this place his own. And Magu was the Dharma heir of Matsu or Basso, who is called the horse master by Suzuki Roshi, who had a tongue that was so long that he could touch his nose. I never read this, but Suzuki Roshi always told me these things about these guys. I don't know where he found them. That's how he remembered them. The horse master with a tongue so long that he could touch his nose. Very deep, huh? So Magu was the Dharma heir of Matsu. So Matsu had been his teacher, and then he transmitted. He gave Magu authorization to teach. So he's one of the main guys in this little story I'm going to read. Second guy is Rinzai. All Japanese Rinzai came from Linchi. But Linchi also is related to the horse master, but he's the grandson of the horse master, lineage-wise, right? Lineage-wise. That means he practiced with the horse master, then he went and fooled around. I don't know if he fooled around. Then he came back and practiced with one of the horse master's chief Dharma heirs, chief lineage holders, and became a Dharma heir himself. So it's kind of like... If some of you know Norm Randolph, right? Norm Randolph, who was here. Norm and I got ordained at the same time here by Katagiri Roshi. And Norm is at Dharma Fields now. And we're both the same age. We're both senior citizens. And we practiced together here for years. Norm is a direct disciple of Katagiri Roshi's, but I went off and fooled around and came back. So I'm the grandson. And Karen Suna was my teacher. She gave me Dharma transmission. So Norm and I are friends and hang out together. Don't fight too much. Unless we do it playfully. So, setting the ground for this story, right? So this story is about Magu and Linchi. Norm and Tim. Why not? Magu visited Linchi. He spread out his sitting cloth and asked, "The Avalokiteshvara has 12 faces. Which one is the true face?" The Avalokiteshvara has 12 faces. Which one is the true face? Linchi, this is Linchi's temple in this vignette. Lin Chi's temple. Lin Chi is sitting not on a brown cushion, but on a brown cordless chair, cross-legged. If you see the old pictures of the Chinese teachers, they're mostly sitting in these chairs, but they're sitting with straight backs, and they're sitting in full or half lotus. Somebody could research that for me, or for us. So anyway, Lin Chi came down from the corridor chair. He folded the sitting cloth and hung it on one hand, and with the other hand he held Ma Gu and said, "Where has the 12-faced Avalokiteshvara gone?" Ma Gu turned his body and tried to sit on Lin Chi's corner chair. Lin Chi held his monk's staff and hit Ma Gu. Ma Gu grabbed his staff, both held on one end of it, and went off to Lin Chi's room. That's the story. It's the whole story. So, let's go through this again. Let's go through this. So, here we have, you can think about it this way, point, counterpoint, point, counterpoint, aha, or something. You can think about it that way. You don't have to, but that's one way to think about it. So, Norm comes in. I'm sitting here with you guys. I don't know what Norm's doing here in the first place, but I always invite him over. He never comes, but let's say this time he comes. Norm comes in. I'm sitting with you. And Norm, in China, they didn't sit on zabatons. They couldn't afford zabatons. Instead, they sat on these bowing cloths that we have, these zagus that I use on Monday through Saturday that we use. They sat on these. They spread them and sat on them. So, and the Chinese were formal, like the Japanese. So he comes in, he spreads his sitting cloth to sit down in front of me. And what do? I do something not too polite. Especially, you guys may think it's polite. In China, it was not polite. Was not polite. But I do that after he says an impolite question to me, right? Avalokiteshvara has 12 faces. Which one is the true face? Which one is your true place? Is your true place someplace else? Where is your true place? Which one? Which of your faces, which of your personas is the true one? So he's challenging me. Am I really in this place? Or am I got one of my personas that's better than the other one that I want to show, that I want to manifest here in front of all of you guys with Norm here? It better be good, right? And Norm takes up a lot of the room, too. He's about 6'4", I think. I don't know. Seems to be getting... I don't know if he's always been big to me. So Norm asked me, the Avalokiteshvara has 12 faces. Which one's the true face? And when the question is about Avalokiteshvara, it's always about helping. Because that's what help Avalokiteshvara does with his faces. With his faces, his arms and hands, his helps. But usually we're so busy trying to figure out the right way to help that we don't really help from our deepest place. Our deepest place. So I come down from my corner chair. I fold Norm's sitting cloth so he can't sit down. I hang it on one hand. And with the other hand, I hold Norm. Although, you know, I guess I think I have to get a ladder to hold Norm. I guess I have a little step ladder here that's, you know, nicely decorated. It's got some Buddhas around it. I don't know. It doesn't really work visually. Maybe Norm kneels. Let's have Norm prostrating. Norm prostrates. Okay. Much better.
Okay.
Anyway, maybe I leap up. I grab Norm, shake him, and I say, "Where has the 12-faced Avalokiteshvara gone? Where has the 12-faced Avalokiteshvara gone?" And then Norm turns his body and tries to sit on my cushion. Then I do the thing that is really fun. I get out my kisaku and I whap Norm. Right? Like we used to do in the old days in San Francisco. Our teachers used to do to us, too, here, but especially in San Francisco. That was before we got into Zen political correctness. Now nobody does that anymore. So I whack him with my kisaku. And what does he do? He grabs the staff, but he doesn't take it from me. He just grabs it securely, strongly, and we saunter out of the room together and up to my office. We saunter out of the room and up to my office. That's the story. That's the story. So when I was in the sixth or seventh grade, I had my parents sent me to ballroom dancing. I won't tell you too much about my background, but you can gather what my background was like when I tell you that. They sent us all to ballroom dancing in the sixth or seventh grade. And ballroom dancing, well, none of us guys like ballroom dancing. And I won't tell you all the things we did, but we did a lot of things. But, well, anyway, I won't get into that, I guess. And I was not great at ballroom dancing. I was probably in the bottom quartile, or maybe the bottom something tile in ballroom dancing. And our teacher was Mr. Chris and Miss Boone. And Miss Boone was old. She was maybe 40. She was old. And she had bleached blonde hair. We knew it was bleached. We knew it couldn't be a real hair at 40. We always made fun of her. You know, when we were out and back, chewing tobacco is actually what we were doing. We stole tobacco from, well, I went across the street from the drugstore and went and chewed it on the break. We did that. Although, I only did it once, and I won't tell you why. Yeah. Getting ready for the counterculture. So well, I didn't do very well. I was in the bottom part of the bottom quartile, right? So I had the privilege I didn't like of dancing with Miss Boone. And Miss Boone took me as a partner a lot. And it was embarrassing. It was scary. And especially with my friends there. That was what made it awful. If she had just taken me aside and we'd gone down the hall, nobody had known. But everybody seeing that I had to dance with Miss Boone, hard for me. Talk about not being in your place. I felt so out of place. But she just kept at it. She didn't do it. There were three of us that she did it with, and three out of, 20 guys or something, 20 boys, 20, I don't remember how many, 20, 25. And I never knew when my turn was going to come up, but I used to try to go hide when I thought it was my turn. But I always, it never worked, and I had to dance with her. But at first it was awful, but after a while it was pretty good, because Miss Boone, led me, but she led me without being pushy. She led me and she guided me, and we did the waltz and the foxtrot, and, well, we never got to the tango, but well, they tried to teach us the tango too, but we did the waltz and the foxtrot, and some nights it was just dancing. It was just dancing. When I was with her, that was. And I didn't feel awkward anymore, and I didn't feel self-conscious, and I felt in my place. in my place. Then the dance would be over, and my friends would be teasing me, and I didn't feel in my place anymore. But then after a few months, I was really looked forward to dancing with Miss Boone. Because unlike my parents, she didn't criticize me. She did guide me. She did kind of push me sometimes, but you couldn't tell it. You couldn't tell it. Because she was really in her place. She had really found her place. Now, whether that emanated beyond the dance floor or not, I don't know. So this is what Zen practice is about. Slowly but surely settling in to what we are, to who we are, to this place. Doing what we love is a great way to help that. And when we absolutely can't do what we love, loving what we do. Loving what we do. And then there's no gap. There's no gap between doing what we love and loving what we do. There's just life. So I'm going to finish with this poem by Alice Notley. I'm losing my bacaws in the pines. In chance, in fortune, in luck. There is no because. Once I had, and now I don't. In love, there is no because. So when we make this place our own, because is there, but it's not the main thing. The main thing is being with this, is dancing with this, even if the dance seems awkward at first. Taking care of this, even if it's hard to take care of this. And that's really all Zen is. I don't know anything else, especially about Zen. So, I think that's probably enough on a warm early July day. Comments, questions, stories?
Tim, you said that Mio Zen was being selfish going to China.
You could say that. You wouldn't have to say that.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe I don't need that.
Yeah, well, go ahead. No,
well,
go ahead.
I was just wondering about that because it seems like, you know, Dogen had this yearning to go to China.
Yeah.
But also perhaps Mio Zen had a yearning that he felt like he
That's right. And That's
it,
right.
And when you were first telling the story, it almost, the way you framed it sounded like Mio Zen's teacher was being selfish, wanting him to sit.
You could say that. You could say that.
And so.
Just depends on your interpretation, but that's just as good an interpretation. I wanted to make the point that sometimes we're too critical of ourselves for doing something we think is selfish. And, you know, we don't need to be critical of that. If it really comes from our hearts, if it's really from a deep desire, we should honor that. We should honor that. That was my point. But your interpretation of the story is just as good. That's the great thing about these Chinese stories. Great. Multiplicity of interpretations. Even Dogen, you know, one essay he's interpreting this way and the other essay another way. So. Other questions?
How old was Dogen when he died?
Pardon?
How old was Dogen when he died?
Dogen or Mio Zen?
Dogen.
Dogen was 52 and Mio Zen was 40. Dogen was 53 and Dogen and Mio Zen, who died in China, was only 42. But people didn't live to be that old in those days. Well, that's what people think. I think so too, but that's not. I mean, let's be overly adulatory. I agree with you, but I just need, we all need to be careful. We need to adulate this place, and include Dogen in it, but not run after him as if he's going to be our savior. This place is our savior. Sorry. It is. It's wonderful. It's awful.
This is as good as it gets.
This is as good as it gets. And better. Infinitely better. Anything else this morning, guys? Thank you.